First of all, welcome everyone. My name is Dr. Akram Khatir. I'm a professor of history here at North Carolina State University, where I also serve as a director of the Moiz Khairallah Center for Lebanese Diaspora Studies. So thank you for joining us today for this episode of Tarikh, our webinar series, where we explore the history of Lebanon and its diaspora through conversations with outstanding scholars. In these discussions, we hope to gain deeper insights into Lebanese history in all of its dimensions, be they political, economic, cultural, environmental, or social. Our focus will be primarily on the modern history of Lebanon across the 19th and 20th centuries, but we'll certainly make forays into earlier periods as well. If there are particular topics that you would like to hear more about, then please let us know by emailing us at lebanesestudies@ncsu.edu, and we will be putting that in the chat. Before we go on to our thing, I'd like to share with you our mission statement, just so you have an idea for those of you who have not encountered the Khairallah Center. And as you can see, our mission is to preserve and share the history of Lebanese immigrants throughout the world. Now, on behalf of the center, I would like to welcome you to this webinar on the Nahda period in the history of Lebanon and other parts of the Ottoman Empire. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Osama Maqdisi, who is a professor of history and chancellor's chair at the University of California, Berkeley. In this conversation, we will explore a period in Lebanese Ottoman history and really a history of Al-Mashriq, by which Al-Mashriq, we mean anything in the Arab world in terms of Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, and Jordan, and sometimes we include Al-Iraq as well. So a period in the history, and then in where we have thinkers, intellectuals in Bilad al-Sham began to imagine, discuss, and implement a new and secular political order to replace the old Ottoman system. Now I am really excited to introduce Dr. Osama Maqdisi, who, as I said, is a professor of history and the chancellor's chair at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Maqdisi's most recent book is Age of Coexistence, The Ecumenical Frame and the Making of the Modern Arab World, and that will be the center piece of our conversation today. His previous books include Faith Misplaced, The Progress and Promise of U.S.-Arab Relations, Artillery of Heaven, American Missionaries and the Failed Conversion of the Middle East, which was a winner of multiple awards, and The Culture of Sectarianism, Community, History, and Violence in 19th Century Ottoman Lebanon. He has published widely on Ottoman and Arab history, as well as on U.S.-Arab relations and U.S. missionary work in the Middle East. Among his major articles are Anti-Americanism in the Arab World, An Interpretation and Brief History, which appeared in the Journal of American History, and Ottoman Orientalism and Reclaiming the Land of the Bible, Missionary Secularism and Evangelical Modernity, both of which appeared in the American Historical Review. Osama, welcome to Tarikh and welcome to the Khairallah Center.
Thank you so much, Akram. It's really great to be with you and to be at the center virtually. I wish it were in person, but honestly, I'm really impressed with the work that you've done and really grateful to you and to all the staff for this kind of extraordinary archival and, as you said, creative work that you've enabled in this and through the center. So thank you to you.
Thank you so much, Osama. I really appreciate you saying that. So as you and I discussed before, I really want to start out with a very simple thing. Our audience is a mixed group of people, undergraduate, graduate students, as well as scholars and the general public. So before we get talking about your book, what I really wanted to do is ask you a question, if you can reflect a little bit and share with us how it is the path that took you to become probably one of the preeminent Middle East historians today.
Well, I mean, I think I, as you know, I grew up in Lebanon during the war and the civil war in Lebanon. And I think as a result of that, I was sort of motivated to pursue sort of, I knew that the reality that I lived and experienced and that many of us lived and experienced in Lebanon was not reflected in the way the war was represented or reported as simply a Muslim-Christian conflict. You remember that, the way the war was always represented in binary terms. And I knew that the history was, the reality of the present was much more complex. And that sort of spurred me into doing history. At a time, as you know, Akram, when the, you know, I'm privileged because my parents, of course, are both academics, writers, thinkers. And so in that sense, it's sort of they always encouraged me to pursue my sort of passion in history. And so I ended up going to the U.S. and majoring in history in college. And from then, And thinking about sectarianism really, and thinking about the representation of our part of the world as a place that is mired in endless religious fanaticism, and I knew that was wrong. I knew that that needed to be historicized, so that pushed me to go into history. Why the Middle East is because I guess because I grew up in the region, and because I feel attached to the region.
Thank you so much, Osama, for that. So let's shift a little bit more specifically about your latest book, The Age of Coexistence. I'm kind of curious, what was the impetus? This kind of feeds a little bit as a good segue as well in terms of this book. But I'm kind of curious, what really led you to this book and writing it?
Well, I mean, this is tied to, I mean, again, as I say in the beginning, so every history of sectarianism is also a history of coexistence, in the sense that we live in a part of the world that's got an extraordinarily rich history, as you know, as a historian, an incredibly complicated history, a beautiful history in many ways, and yet a history that is typically represented in a one-dimensional manner of, as I said, fanaticism, sectarianism, religious atavism, hatreds, and so on and so forth. And I wanted to give people a sense that give people a sense that there's an entire history of coexistence in a complicated but meaningful way that needs to be excavated, needs to be remembered, and that is today either denigrated or forgotten or denied. And I think it was really important for me to turn the narrative around from simply saying we're not like this to saying this is what we're like. In other words, to go from rebutting stereotypes, Orientalist stereotypes, or racist stereotypes, or chauvinisms, and so on, or to basically to go from that to representing something I think more positive, to tell a more positive story. So along the lines of the Haidallah Center, to go from sort of documenting a past that is being denied or ignored or forgotten, and then narrating that past in ways that sort of defy what many of us think about our contemporary reality, which is to say that we're heirs to a profound history of coexistence, a dynamic history of coexistence, a history that especially along Muslim Christian lines, that is extraordinarily important, but that has to be sort of remembered and historicized and narrated, because it's something that we should be proud of collectively, but also we should be critical of as well. I mean, the combination of, I think that's in a very general sense, that's what I would say, sort of pride in not pride, I don't want to sound chauvinistic, but sort of an awareness of the importance of narrating this history in more positive terms, and at the same time being always aware of the need to be critical. So that combination.
Thank you for that answer. So let's delve a little bit into the book, and to give people a better idea about what you're focusing on and some of the histories that you have unearthed and reconceptualized and reframed. So the book is really two parts. The first part really deals with the late Ottoman period, which you define as, the 1840s, 1860s, all the way up to World War I. And then we're moving on to the Mandate period, in which Britain and France take over what we know today as the Middle East, and subdivide, or at least participate in subdividing it into nation states. So let's talk about the first part. Now, the first part, as I said, focuses on the late Ottoman Empire and the transition away from its system of Muslim privilege and, quote, deep formal inequality, end quote, which you argue led to the intellectual and political ecumenical frame, this idea of an ecumenical frame. So I found that to be an incredibly engaging two words, actually. The ecumenical part and the frame part for me were a very engaging way of telling the story. But I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit, what is the ecumenical frame, and how does it revise Orientalist understandings of sectarianism?
Well, the ecumenical frame is just my way of talking about a history of coexistence between Muslims, Christians, Jews, within Christian communities, within Muslim communities, within Jewish communities. There's an extraordinary religious diversity in our part of the world. And our modern history has been the attempt to try to transform to recognize that diversity, to embrace that diversity, and to accept the reality of difference, religious, ethnic, communal, sectarian difference, and then to figure out ways of transcending. I mean, that's the history of the 19th century. How do people transcend that difference without actually ignoring or denying that difference? That's the ecumenical part. In other words, you just like in Christianity and in Islam, you can be ecumenical if you're Muslim and say you accept Sunnis and Shiites together and you transcend that difference because you recognize the commonalities being Muslim. Same with Christians. You can be Protestant, Catholic, and so on in many different sects of Protestantism, and you can transcend these differences because you recognize that there's something that you agree on more fundamentally, which is, you know, in the Christian case, Jesus Christ and God and so on and so forth. That same idea, I'm taking that idea and adapting it to our part of the world to say that we recognize difference, we embrace difference, we don't try to ignore or erase difference and make everyone the same. But we also, there was an attempt in the 19th century at an Ottoman level, but then also at an Arab level, and even at a Lebanese level, to sort of transcend religious and ethnic difference and sectarian difference and focus on the commonality, but without erasing difference. I think the key here is that we're not trying to, it's not like the French or others who say we're going to erase everyone's sort of religious, you know, being, and sort of you're going to be just one thing. We don't have that. So the idea of the ecumenical is the idea of accepting religious difference, sectarian difference, communal difference, and at the same time transcending it. That's the ecumenical part. The frame just is a reference to the idea that we lived in an Ottoman environment, and the frame refers to the political frame, it refers to the cultural frame, it refers to the fact that the scaffolding upon which our culture of coexistence, our modern culture of coexistence developed, depended on this sort of environment, the political, legal, social environment that nurtured and that allowed for the development of very new ideas of being Ottoman, being Arab, being Lebanese, etc., so on, being Syrian, in ways that help people transcend religious difference. So the framing is crucial, because we really, our development, our modern history of coexistence is really this point between an older history of coexistence, which was the older Ottoman model, the older Islamic model, which of course recognized religious difference, but in an Islamic imperial polity. So there was coexistence, but there wasn't equality. The challenge, of course, is what happens in the 19th century. How do you transform that old system with its important legacies, its contradictions, its tensions, and so on and so forth? How do you transform that into a modern system? How do you take difference, recognize difference, and also then develop an idea of equality? That was the challenge of the 19th century. And I think in the Arab provinces, in places like Beirut, in Cairo, in Damascus, in Jerusalem and other parts, Haifa and other parts of the Ottoman Arab East, there was an explosion of writing and thinking and teaching in the 19th century that emphasized this idea that we could both be Muslim and Christian and Jewish and at the same time be Ottoman or be Arab. That's what I was referring to.
So let me follow up on that. So what was driving this at this particular historical moment? Because one of the things you do very well in this book, as in other books, is to historicize these moments, to say this is not an immemorial way of being, that this region we call the Middle East is as historical as every other region. So what is driving it at this moment that we see what ultimately we come to call the Nahda period, this kind of renaissance, you know, uplift? Imagine this. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, what's driving it is, I mean, it's a combination, it's a dialectic, it's both. I mean, what's driving it is both circumstances, politics, economy, culture, the entire sort of world in which people were living. There was huge amounts of change in the 19th century. The Ottoman Empire was subjected to massive external pressures. Napoleon's invasion of Egypt in 1798, the Greek War of Independence in the 1820s, culminating the establishment of a Greek kingdom. The rebellion of Muhammad Ali against Ottoman rule, and so on and so forth. There were massive pressures on the Ottomans, and that the Ottoman state, in other words, and that forced them to embark on what historians refer to as the Reformation, the Tanzimat, or the reordering of the empire. which tried to change the empire from being an empire of subjects, of unequal subjects, to being an empire of citizens. It's a paradox. It's in that moment in the mid-19th century that allowed the space to develop for the idea of thinking, okay, so what does it mean to be an Ottoman citizen? What does it mean to be modern? What does it mean to be civilized in the 19th century? So these are the ideas, and these are the context and the moments that the major frame. It's the Ottoman state and the laws of the state and the reformation of the state that allowed people locally on the ground to start thinking in extraordinarily creative ways and new ways about, okay, so how do we update our, and how do we transform the legacy that we have, the history that we have of coexistence, and sort of adapt it to the world that we want to build, a modern world. So that's at a very broad level. Then locally, you have specific examples. I talk about this in the book, of course. You have in reaction to this huge transformation. And the point I make in the book, Akram, as you know, is that we should stop being ashamed of our history as Lebanese, as Arabs, as people from the region, whether we're Arabs or not Arabs or Lebanese, or it doesn't matter where you're from, we shouldn't be ashamed of the history. There are contradictions, there are tensions. There were moments that today we look back and say, they were pretty awful moments, including, of course, there were people who were opposed to this change. There were people who had vested interests in the old system. And there were economic dislocations in the 19th century. There was a lot of political pressure on the Ottomans. And among the things that occurs is the first major anti-Christian riot that takes place in Damascus in 1860, in July of 1860. And there are economic reasons for this. There are political reasons for this. We're not taught this history, of course, in Lebanon or in the Middle East in general. I doubt we're taught these kinds of histories, because it was a major riot. But it's a riot that takes place in a context of these dislocations, of the economic transformations, of political interventions, of massive pressures on Ottoman sovereignty, and there was a backlash. And so so historians, especially Orientalists, have looked at these moments and said, "Look, you see, Muslims attack Christians. That means Muslims can't be modern." And the reality is, of course, is that it's not all Muslims who attack; it's some. So we need to contextualize, and many Muslims protected the Christians in Damascus. And more to the point, out of this terrible moment in July of 1860, out of this terrible moment of a sectarian urban massacre or riot, there were people like Butrus al-Bustani, an educator, a thinker, a reformer, who was living at the time in Beirut, who basically realized that the region as a whole, Syria, he called it, because then, of course, there was no state of Lebanon, there was no state of Syria, this was all under Ottoman sovereignty. He realized that the region was at a crossroads, and that, you know, in the midst of these huge transformations, as the empire was trying to go from being an empire of subjects to being an empire of citizens, at a time of massive European interventions, at a time of pressures, and at a time of sectarian riots, people had a choice to make, just like today. People have a choice to make. They could either give in to their sectarian sort of prejudices, or they could inculcate a new way of being, a new way of thinking about their religious heritage and their sort of diversity. And so what happens is that he then really opens the first school that I'm aware of, the first school in the Ottoman Empire, that is an ecumenical school that really sort of says, you can be whoever you want to be. You can be Muslim, Christian, Jewish, you can be anything you want, and you should know your own history, but at the same time, you're part of a greater community. And so he develops a school called Al-Madrasa al-Wataniya in the early 1860s. And it's an extraordinarily important school. It's an extraordinarily important moment. He's recognized by the Ottoman state, who say this is exactly the kind of new education and new being that we want to cultivate. So my point is, it's a choice that we all make. Do you give in, just like in America today? Do you give in to your worst impulses and say, and you see in diversity danger, or do you look at diversity and say you see opportunity and you see potential for building something greater than the sum of their parts? And again, Bustani, among many others, embraced this moment and said, there's an opportunity in the mid-19th century to develop a greater sense of who we are as a community that transcends religious difference without denying religious difference.
So I'm going to follow up a little bit on that, but I just wanted, because you mentioned Al-Madrasa Al-Wataniya, which we usually translate as a national school. And here is kind of, it's a larger question. Butros al-Bustani and others who are thinking, you know, who are part of these societies and communities of thinkers who are trying to develop new ways of being, are they thinking outside the frame of the Ottoman Empire? Because we use the term national, so I kind of want to, or are they thinking that they are part of this Ottoman Empire and they're reshaping it from within? I mean, how are they imagining at this point their political future, so to speak?
Well, someone like, I mean, again, that is a context. We have to be very specific and contextual, because it depends on the person, it depends on the context, it depends on the city, it depends on the moment. But in the case of Bustani, for example, he was thinking himself both as an Ottoman and as a Syrian, as an Arab, in other words, both. And he didn't see a contradiction between the two. So he was absolutely a subject of the, and eventually a citizen of the empire, for sure. I mean, he didn't see himself as politically separating from the empire, as opposed to the Greeks and the Serbians and others who were separating from the empire. He didn't see he wasn't presenting an alternative political sort of project in that sense, but he was also way ahead of the Ottoman statesmen, because the Ottoman statesmen are reforming to maintain the integrity of the empire. So equality is just a means to their goal, which is to preserve their empire. And that's the ultimate goal. So if something else comes along that's more important, they'll do that to preserve the empire. They'll get rid of equality if it means preserving the empire. Whereas Bustani was really an individual, an educator, as I said, a reformer, a pedagogue. And he was much more invested in the idea of actually developing a new consciousness of being a Syrian, that sort of trend, which of course is still important today, a Syrian that transcends religious difference, that embraces religious difference, but also transcends it. So I think it's both. He was both an Ottoman, but also an Arab Syrian.
So I'm kind of also curious, because as you note in your book, a lot of these individuals who are formulating this new frame, like Butros al-Bustani, are also ones who are very class conscious, not in terms of socioeconomic, but in terms of intellectual pedigree. And so they see that, you know, there is kind of this subclass of people who are illiterate, ignorant, you know, and violent, and then they themselves as the enlightened ones. So aside from that kind of bias that is inherent in that, I'm kind of curious, as you were doing research and looking into this, what role did women, did peasants, did working class people have in shaping this ecumenical frame? Not necessarily, obviously, in sitting there writing, perhaps, although they may have, but more importantly, in terms of imagining something different.
Well, I mean, obviously, women, it goes without saying that women are absolutely an essential part of the ecumenical frame, both in terms of, of course, being sort of obviously like a massive part of the very communities that we're talking about. And the fact, both in other words, as objects of education, but also as agents of education, as agents of people who are mobilizing in their own right in the 19th and 20th century, developing and thinking through about, again, what is the role of women in this society? What is the role of mothers? What is the role of women in the nation, and so on and so forth? These were all sort of massive, vital debates that were taking place. And of course, there were, just like with Bustani, there were people who were more conservative, people who were more, I would say, let's say more liberal, or people who were more secular, people who were more pious, at every level, men and women. And there were major female women educators, journalists, thinkers, writers, and so on. So you're right to point out that in the book, I do focus on intellectuals, because the point that I make is that in the book is that it was in schools and in journals and schools and newspapers and books that you see the most obvious and the most evident sort of expressions of this new ecumenical identity. But of course, eventually what happens is that these people want to reach out, and do reach out in many instances, and the state reaches out in turn to sort of what you call other classes. And they're all affected by the laws of the empire. But of course, the priorities are different depending on what your class is, what your position is, what your work is, and so on and so forth. But yeah, these people did, of course, have bias. Bustani had bias. But I think we should also be, we should be wary about this, Akram. We should sort of, again, because it's a common thing in American academia to say, oh, these people are elitist. You know, today Bustani is an elite. I mean, what does it mean to say he's an elitist? I mean, yes, he may be an elitist at one level, but he's not the Sultan. There's a different level of elite. I mean, he is, after all, a convert. You know, he was a convert. He did work as a printer. He worked in a press. He worked as a translator. So, you know, he wasn't a rich man in that sense of being elitist. And his intellectual project was, in fact, revolutionary. It was a revolutionary project and a really important project. So I think we should, of course, always be aware of the class and the social dimensions of all these individuals. But we also should be wary before we start throwing out sort of terms like elitist, because we use that as a way to avoid actually delving into their thought. I mean, so Rousseau is also an elitist, and Hannah Arendt is an elitist. And by the same token, you see what I'm saying? All these intellectuals are elitist, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't take their thoughts and thinking and writing seriously.
Of course.
And the same in our part of the world too. And we often immediately go right away to say, okay, let's find the authentic Easterner, and as if these people are not authentic in their own right.
Oh, absolutely. So let's situate this argument that you're presenting into the larger debate. So in the past decade or so, some scholars of the Middle East have been deeply critiqued secularism as a quote unquote Western import, whose ideological tenets and praxis stood at odds with the local histories and traditions of Middle Eastern societies. In The Age of Coexistence, your book, you argue for a different approach, one in which secularism has multiple genealogies, including a local one in the 19th century. So I was wondering if you can elaborate. And
yeah, I mean, it's not just, of course, it's not just scholars, of the Middle East in America who have made this argument that secularism is somehow a foreign import. It's also people in the Middle East, especially the more religious and conservative types who've made this argument time and again, that secularism is simply a Western import. And the reality is, of course, secularism, like many, many, many other ideas, are circulating around the world and have different expressions. And in our part of the world, the point about the reason, again, why I go back to the ecumenical part is to insist that as people are grappling with what does it mean to be Ottoman, what does it mean to be Arab, what does it mean to be civilized, what does it mean to be a modern man or a modern woman in the Ottoman context or in the post-Ottoman, the immediate post-Ottoman world, there are people who are, in fact, secular, who gravitate towards secularism. There are people who gravitate towards piety. There are people who gravitate towards religious expression. There are religious people who also insist on a secular political frame. And there are, you see what I'm saying? There's a whole range of expression. And so the idea of saying that the secular people are mimicking the West misses the point completely. It's like, that's, to me, that's an irrelevant, that criticism doesn't make any sense, because it doesn't actually take into account the actual histories of people on the ground, their feelings, their ideas, their worldviews, their ambitions. And to me, that's much more important than frankly, whether or not secularism originates in the West or doesn't originate in the West. That's not, for me, a very interesting point. It goes back into this point of like, what is authentic? And the point is, people borrow from many different things from all parts of the world, and so too are part of the world. And that's, I'm more interested in seeing how do they take these ideas and how do they go with these ideas? How do they elaborate these ideas? I mean, you could say the same thing about equality. In fact, I was just on the East Coast. I won't go into too many details, but a person was basically pushing me to acknowledge that equality is a Western idea. And, you know, again, this is such an old-fashioned, unproductive way of thinking about equality. So I told him, look, the historian, a good historian, he wasn't a historian, a good historian would basically say, rather than say what is equality Western or Eastern or whatever, why not just say, look at how the principle of equality, citizenship, emerges in the 19th century and how it is contested in very different contexts, and how people fight for it and people fight against it in America, in the Middle East, in Europe, you know, in India, and so on and so forth. You see what I'm saying? And like, the point is, like, look at that. That's a much more productive way. And the same for secularism. So the secularism versus Islamism, you know, versus piety, just again is a debate that takes place in the Middle East, as other parts of the world. And the point is to understand that there's a range of ideas and beliefs. And the point about the ecumenical frame, finally, the last point I'd like to make on this is that whether you were a secularist or you were an Islamist or you were a Christian, a fundamentalist, or whether you were a liberal, a pietist, whatever you were, all these people, this is the crucial part, all these people, these individuals in the 19th century, Arab East in particular, understood that they lived in a diverse world and that there was no getting beyond this diverse world. That's the crucial point. So it's not about, and so some said, of course, it's more authentic to be X, it's more authentic to be Y. That's in the nature of a vibrant living culture and society. People debate these issues. But the point is they didn't negate each other. That's the crucial bit. And our part of the world in the Arab East, in the Mashriq, under Ottoman rule, this is the crucial part in the book also. We did not develop ethno-religious nationalisms in al-Mashriq al-Arabi, in the Arab East. We did not. We, in fact, more so than even, I'll say, the Ottoman state, we embraced this idea of Ottomanism and inhabited it and embodied it in all the debates and the diversity and all that stuff. So, but we didn't develop this idea that the state, the Mashriq only belongs to community X or community Y. We didn't have that. And that's, again, part of the richness that we need to remember and recover.
Thank you so much for that eloquent answer. I wanted to shift to the second part of your book, but before I do that, we have a couple of questions that pertain to the first half, and I thought this would be a good idea to at least open them up here. So we have one question that says, practically speaking, do you see the ecumenical frame ever fitting within the shape of the modern nation state, or are they effectively incompatible?
Well, it depends on the nation state. Not every nation state is the same, and of course you could say what happens and the book traces this, of course, in the second part. But what happens, you go from an Ottoman sort of ecumenical frame, and even within the Ottomans, as I say, in the northern part, in the Balkans and in Anatolia, what happens is that the rise of ethno-religious nationalisms basically overwhelm and the defensiveness and the wars that take place overwhelm the ecumenical culture in the northern part of the empire. In other words, in the Balkans and Anatolia, which is why the Armenian question develops in the 1890s and the genocide takes place in World War I. In other words, it's at the very end of the empire that communities are turned into minorities and then are oppressed in the northern parts of the empires, precisely because of these ethno-religious nationalisms and the Ottoman state reaction to these. You see what I'm saying? So that's in our part of the world, we didn't have that. There were no ethno-religious nationalisms fighting each other. There really wasn't, on any significant scale at least. And so what happens then in the post-Ottoman period is that the ecumenical frame then gets sort of projected on or inhabits or becomes in a sense smaller, because the space is no longer the Ottoman whole. It becomes Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Egypt. And these places, of course, the same idea continues to an extent in the first half of the 20th century. So, but it becomes narrowed to within Lebanese, within Syrian, within Iraqi, within Egypt. And then you still have the ecumenical culture developing and continuing and persisting as people try to figure out how do you balance diversity in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Egypt, with an overarching common national identity. So it's not that it has to be incompatible, but certain projects are obviously militate against the idea of diversity and equality.
Okay, thank you so much, Osama. So I have a comment, so I thought it would be reading. And this is to follow up on Osama's point. People knew they lived in a diverse environment. My own research on Ottoman Tripoli, 18th century, overwhelmingly show ordinary people, men and women, living side by side, interacting on a regular basis, which is kind of the argument that we've seen in like Aleppo, Damascus, and various other places as well. So let me shift a little bit now to the second half of the book. And here's where we go from this kind of incredibly diverse Ottoman Empire, linguistically, religiously, ethnically, in every way you can imagine, this incredibly rich environment, this including in the Arab East, al-Mashriq, to a point in which we see the dissolution of the empire under the weight of World War I and the colonial project by Britain and France, who come in directly or indirectly, and they create, or at least they helped to create what we know today as a modern Middle East, the nation state system as we understand it today. So I was kind of curious here that, and some of the local elites in various places, whether it's Egypt, what we know today as Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, were engaged in this process of nation building themselves. I mean, this is not the sort of omnipotent Europeans coming and we, the passive Arabs, just sit and take it. There's a very interesting dialectical relationship. But I'm kind of curious if you can talk a little bit about how this process, this process of the creation of a nation state and shifting from, from an imperial kind of presence, but a diverse society to a nation state that is a lot more contracted geographically, but possibly also contracted in terms of who belongs and who doesn't. This idea, and how do we shift, how does the ecumenical frame transition, if at all, into this new political system we call Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, or Egypt?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, that's a huge question,
It
and
is.
I can't do it justice in a few minutes. But what I'll say is, first of all, just to go back 2 seconds, because I think we need to clarify for the listeners and for the audience, it's not that the Ottomans were just diverse and it was peaceful. I mean, there was a lot of violence in the 19th century, and as I said, the Ottoman state project ultimately was a state project. And when equality and diversity and so on and pluralism got in the way of the state project, that diversity was ultimately targeted and destroyed. And hence the persecution of the Armenians, hence the Greek-Turkish population exchange after World War I. In other words, it's important to understand that's what makes the Mashrek even more interesting, because in contrast to what was happening in the northern part of the empire, we didn't face these ethno-religious dilemmas, nationalist dilemmas in the 19th century. What happens, of course, after the collapse of the empire, and the very brutal collapse of the empire, is that the Europeans, of course, as you alluded to, the Europeans come in, and this is where again the framing is so important, because the ecumenical frame persists in the Arab East. The difference is that now it's not that the Europeans are omnipotent, but they do have an enormous amount of power, because of course they're the ones who draw the map of the modern Middle East. They're the ones who create the states of Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Iraq. And of course, as you said, there is, of course, native agency, and there's a dialectical relationship. There are people on the ground, there are elites on the ground who collaborate with the French and the British. But in the end, let's be under no illusion as to who's actually drawing the boundaries and the maps. And they're drawing them, and they're separating what we were all under one sovereignty. Suddenly we're divided up into multiple sovereignties. And the European conceit, and it really was a conceit, it's a racist conceit, it's a part and parcel of the European, both British and French thinking, since these are the two major powers that divided up the region, is that they believed, and this is the great tragedy or the great sort of irony, or that somehow their history of pluralism in their own societies, despite the massive violence against Huguenots, against Jews, against there were no Muslims on any major in France or in England at the time. Despite their colonial violence, despite their racism, all that, they somehow felt that they had a right and an ability and a duty to sort of educate other peoples in the non-West about how to organize a pluralist society that could respect religious difference. That was their great conceit. In other words, in the West, you could have diversity and pluralism. In the East, the colonial powers insisted you could only have sectarianism and religious violence and hatreds that the Europeans needed to manage. That was the great difference in this transition from the Ottoman to the post-Ottoman period. And so the European, the French, basically, and the British looked at the Middle East, and they emphasized difference, not to create a whole, but in fact, precisely to divide up this region into bits and pieces, to control it better. We call it divide and rule, and to exactly what it was. That doesn't mean that, again, that the ecumenical frame disappeared. It just mean it came under huge stress, and it had to sort of had to be adapted to, as you said, these separate nation states that get created, for the interests of the imperial powers, not for the interests of the local populations. That's what I want to emphasize, and I think all the listeners need to, including, by the way, the creation of Lebanon. Yes, of course, there were elites in Lebanon, who, in what would become Lebanon, who were willing to collaborate with the French, in fact, who enthusiastically collaborated with the French. Absolutely, the history is clear about this. But there were many people who were, of course, were opposed to that and who were ignored, and especially in the south, in the Bekaa, in the north, and on the coastal regions. In fact, you could say the majority of the population, in fact, was not obviously consulted in the creation of Lebanon. But nevertheless, in the end, these states are created. And once they're created, they take on a life of their own. And then people have to make a choice again within the state. How do you identify? And what you see developing in every single Arab society in the Mashriq is a, in fact, it's not the end of the ecumenical frame. It's, in fact, in reaction to the European discourse that you're uncivilized, you're always hating each other, you can't be independent, you need our tutelage, you need et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You see, in fact, the development of a huge array of political and social movements that includes the people you were talking about earlier, workers, peasants, citizens of these states, who in fact are adamant to prove, to disprove the European conceit that people in the East are only sectarian. So I think the ecumenical frame in fact thrives even under European colonialism, precisely as a response to the colonial claims that you need the European man to sort of rule over the natives. And so, you, in fact, you see a flourishing in Egypt, in Syria, in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Iraq, of ecumenical thought in the first half of the 20th century. It's in Palestine, of course, where the catastrophe occurs. But that's, you know, I talk about that in the book.
Yeah, and I do want to get to that point in a second. But a couple questions, and we'll start with the first one, which probably is fairly straightforward to answer. At this point, you know, I mean, obviously, when we started out with Boutros Lobostani setting up the first national school certainly in, you know, in the area we know today as Lebanon, but, you know, in the Mashriq, there are a lot of missionary schools that are also going on as well, obviously, both in Egypt, in Iran, we see them in Turkey, but also in Lebanon and Syria. So I'm kind of curious, as we shift to this nation state, you know, model of political sovereignty, where are we seeing sort of an effervescence or an increase in augmentation in this kind of educational movement, you know, knowledge, development, production that is local, that is also feeding into this ecumenical frame that you're talking about?
Absolutely, 100%. There's an explosion of schools and voluntary societies and educational missions, both local and foreign, frankly, both. And the point is, again, because the point of the ecumenical frame is that there's an extraordinary diversity, also educational diversity, in the Mashriq. And of course, there are different kinds of schools. There are schools that cater to one community. There are schools that are missionary schools. There are schools that are, there was an Ottoman state system belatedly set up at the end of the empire. And there were schools like Bustani's and Sekekini's and other schools. And there were women's schools and boys' schools and girls' schools and so on. There was a whole range of schools, and with, just like in any diverse society, with a diverse set of offerings. And you would have to choose where you wanted to go and what opportunities were open to you to because different schools had different emphases. The difference is that the missionary schools, by and large, had an agenda to ultimately convert, whether it's Protestant or Catholic or Orthodox, or shore up a communal sense of identity. Whereas the Bustani school, the national schools, not nationalist, but national schools, they had the goal of actually transcending religious difference, as opposed to all the other ones, which were about sort of reaffirming religious separatism or difference. So there was a whole range of schools.
Let me ask a little bit more about this shifting ecumenical frame. In the 1860s, 1870s, you talked about Boutros Lobostani, but then in chapter 5, which is when you're shifting to this, you talk, and you're focusing on Lebanon in this case, you talk a lot about Michel Chiha.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of curious if you can talk a little bit about him here and explain, you know, the role that you see for him in shaping, or at least trying to shape, a new type of Lebanon with an ecumenical frame.
Michel Chiha specifically?
Well, in general, the group as a whole, but I mean,
it's fascinating. I mean, because, you know, I have a PhD student, or she's no longer a PhD. She finished her PhD, a former PhD student at Rice University, by the name of Sima Farah, who's done this extraordinary work in the archives, in the French archives, to sort of unearth so many of these documents that we don't even know. I didn't know of, and certainly most other people certainly don't know of, because so much of the history of Lebanon, like the history of Syria, is tied up to the French archive, the French sort of mandates and the creation of these mandates. So Sheikha himself and the Lebanese elites, I think you cannot separate their sort of agency from the fact that they're operating within a French colonial frame. Now, we don't, again, we don't typically, we talk about the mandates, we talk about Lebanon, we talk about Lebanese history, but I at least have to insist that we have to also sort of include it in part of again, a dialectic within a French colonial sort of framework, because it's the French who ultimately create the boundaries and the borders. But within that, there was a debate, of course. Once the French create the state, the question then is, and the French, of course, insist on having the ultimate say because it's a despotic system, ultimately. Whatever the Lebanese say is fine, but in the end, the French insisted on always maintaining the ultimate authority. And the French created the state in a way to separate it out from Syria, as part of their whole vision of the East, which is that these are all antagonistic religious communities that can't coexist. But then they create Lebanon. So having said that, within Lebanon there was this debate, and the question is, how do you organize this state, and what role does religion or religious belonging or communalism have in politics? Should you create a secular state, or should you create a state that actually sort of institutionalizes sectarian confessional belonging in politics? And this was a huge debate. And the interesting thing is that it was a debate. From the very beginning of the creation of the state of Lebanon, there was a debate. And the interesting thing is that most people recognized, including Sheikha when he was pushed, they recognized that the ultimate goal should be a secular state that actually transcends sectarian difference. Everyone acknowledged that, or most people acknowledge that, the majority acknowledge that. But then Sheikha comes along with the French, of course, and under huge French pressure. And we still, as I said, we're still basically trying to figure out the actual story itself, because there's so much we don't know. But Sheikha basically comes along and justifies this idea of a Lebanese state that temporarily acknowledges that in politics, in at least the member in parliament, in the Lebanese parliament, you should divide up, you should, or in Lebanese parliament, you should divide up, you should create sectarian quotas to make sure that every community has a sense of belonging to the whole. And then, of course, you have people on the other side who said, yeah, but if you do that, you're going to end up reinforcing these separatist sort of sectarian communal identities. And that's going to defeat any idea of ultimately transcending these identities into a Lebanese identities. Do you see what I'm saying? There's two sides of that debate. The French ultimately come down on the side of the sectarians, and they create the system to play one off the other, I think, and ultimately with the idea that they are the arbiters. And so that's what happens in Lebanon, and that's the debates that take place. But the point is, it's not just the Christians, it's Muslims, Christians, and Druze, and all the other communities in Lebanon who have people on both sides of the debate, both for and against the sectarian system. But in the end, the sectarian system is entrenched in Lebanon politically, as you know. But the interesting thing, it's entrenched politically, but always with this caveat, because they know that it's a dangerous system, and with the caveat that this is a temporary system, and that eventually it should give way to a secular sense of belonging. So they understood that what they were doing was incredibly sort of dangerous. And Lebanon is the only state I know that keeps saying, yes, the system we have, we're putting in, it's a temporary system, and eventually it's going to go away. And the fact that they have to say that tells you that they recognize that they were part of a debate.
So we are running quickly out of time, much as I would love to continue. We have about 6 minutes left. So there is one last thing that I want to say, if we can briefly address it, because in some ways you argue that that's the end of the ecumenical frame, or not completely the end. I don't mean to sound so dramatic, but certainly it's with the rise of the Zionist project that in Palestine, that all of a sudden what we had talked about within the Arab East, certainly within Al-Mashriq, comes to, a rude awakening that there's the system that completely juxtaposes itself against it, which is really an ethno-religious national system that completely rejects any idea of ecumenical behavior. So I'm kind of wondering, if you could talk briefly about that.
And well, just contrast it with the Lebanese system right there. I mean, people often like compare the Lebanese system with the Zionist system, but the reality is that Lebanon has a sectarian system, but it's not the state of the Christians. It's not formally the state of the Christians. It's not legally the state of the Christians. And so I think that's a crucial distinction. Lebanon, in the end, is able to co-opt Muslim and Druze and other elites as part of the system of rule. Whereas in Palestine, as you just said, Zionism, and as I argue in the book, you just have to look and see where do all the major Zionist thinkers of the 19th century come from? They're all coming from Europe. They're answering European questions. They're dealing with European anti-Semitism. They're part of a European history and culture in terms of thinking about, so they want to create a Jewish state. Okay, where do they put the Jewish state in Palestine? What about the indigenous population? Well, indigenous populations in European thinking in the 19th century don't count nearly as much. And the idea of creating an ethno-religious nationalist project, a Jewish state in a multi-religious world, whether it's in Palestine, had it been in Syria, it would have had the same consequences, or Lebanon, it would have had the same consequences exactly. The idea of implanting a project which emerges in Europe, answering European questions, and then imposing it on a multi-religious part of the world, inevitably was catastrophic, as we've seen, as we see until today, right? I mean, so that's very different from the ecumenical sort of frame I was talking about in Lebanon and in Palestine, in Syria, in Egypt, where there are debates within about what constitutes, you know, where do you draw the line between secular and religious? These are always ongoing debates. Should you have a sectarian system or a secular system? These are a national system. These are all debates, but it wasn't that the state is only for one group or one people. And that is truly, truly dangerous. This idea of fusing in a multi-religious part of the world, the idea that the national project only belongs to one religion or one group. Now, that has hugely damaging consequences. The interesting thing is that the Palestinians, in response to the rise of Zionism, which of course, I mean, there were. It's important to say this, Akram. There were many Jews in Palestine who saw this as a problem, who understood the problem, and eventually said, "We can't support this project because this doesn't represent Judaism," and so on and so forth. And these voices and figures also need to be respected. And what happens is that the Palestinians, in response to the catastrophe of the Nakba of 1948, is that you see quite interesting the Palestinian movement develops along Muslim-Christian lines of solidarity, which itself draws on the earlier history of the ecumenical frame from the 19th century, before Zionism emerged and before Palestinian identity in its modern form emerged either.
So we have one last question. It's a big question, but I would like to ask it. And it's kind of a more forecasting rather than looking back question. And the question is, I assume that you're talking about the historical ecumenical frame because you want to emphasize that it's still possible today.
Yes, of course. I mean, history, I mean, everything changes. The point about history and the point about being a historian is that it's not just like an interest in the past. It's an interest in the past because we believe ultimately, at least I'll speak for myself, because I believe that we have this extraordinary rich history, and we need to reconstitute the present and the future, drawing on elements of our past. And you see what I'm saying? So the question, but of course, there is an argument. You pick and choose what you want to emphasize.
Right.
And ideally, you can see that we have an extraordinarily rich history that, as I said, has been denigrated, has been denied, has been orientalized. That is scarcely recognizable today. When you look back today, all you see are broken states, destroyed societies, and well, that's a function of mid to late 20th century politics and history, and the decisions that have been taken both by Western powers and also by local rulers.
So the hard part of the question is: do you have any suggestions for ways in which this idea of the ecumenical frame can be put into effect today in Lebanon, for example?
Yes, read the histories. I mean, the point is like understand. The most important thing is consciousness. Understand that we do have this history and this heritage, that we're not tied to being, sectarian, or, do you see what I'm saying? I mean, and the current system in Lebanon, in any case, has collapsed, as we all know. I mean, Lebanon now is in a state of complete collapse. The sectarian system is a complete is in complete sort of downfall right now. So I think inevitably there's going to have to be a reimagination if we want a better future. But that's not for me alone, obviously.
Well, Osama, I'm afraid we're out of time. I cannot thank you enough for taking so much of your very overwhelmed schedule to be with us today. And we appreciate you really being here. I apologize if we didn't get some of the questions you asked, but hopefully we have been able to shed some light on the 19th century and early 20th century period in Arab Lebanese history, where many in Bilad al-Sham began to imagine, discuss, and implement a new and secular political order to replace the old Ottoman system as we talked.